Hello, and welcome to another episode of Balanced Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to reintroduce to you today. Zach Bitter is a returning guest on our show. Be sure to check out his first appearance on episode 87 of Balanced Body Radio. Zach Bitter is an American ultra marathon runner and performance coach for endurance athletes. He held world records for the 100-mile run and the 12-hour run. Zach claimed both records with his performance in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on August 24th, 2019. After claiming the 100-mile record, Bitter continued running for another 40 minutes and upped his own 12-hour distance world record to 104.8 miles, an improvement of more than 3 miles over the previous mark. Over the last several years, Zach has been following a largely ketogenic approach and using nutrient-dense carbohydrates strategically to support periods of heavy training and racing. In particular, he uses a ketogenic eating strategy to support improved recovery after hard workouts and races, as well as to maintain his tremendous fat-burning ability. Zach is also the host of the massively successful podcast, Human Performance Outliers, and I listen to every episode. You can find Zach at www.zachbitter.com. Zach Bitter, what an honor it is to welcome you back to Balanced Body Radio.
Thanks so much for having me back on, Casey.
Absolutely, such an honor. So what have you been up to in the last year since we talked? Any big goals, any big training events you're looking to do, accomplish this year?
Yeah. So my wife and I moved to Austin earlier this year. So we're sort of kind of settled at this point, as settled as you can be, I guess, given the way the world works nowadays. But it's been, obviously there's a few extra hurdles to get over when you're moving to a different state when it comes to kind of training for races and things like that. But similar to Arizona, Texas has a pretty big local ultra running scene in terms of like events that are in the state. And I do like to use kind of smaller, closer to home events as kind of buildups towards like whatever my goal events are going to be. And I'll usually pick two or three that are ones that I'm going to, you know, hopefully be able to bring myself dry at. And so far this year, I've done a couple smaller local ones here in Texas, the J&J Reunion, which is a 42-mile race, and then the Brazos Bend 50K. And the slightly bigger event that I've done so far is the Speed Project, actually, which is a really new event that I've never done anything quite like before, where you have a 6-person relay that goes from the Santa Monica Pier in LA to Las Vegas. And wow, it's like just under 300 miles, and you can structure however you want, essentially, amongst those. So I think I ended up running somewhere in the neighborhood of 64-ish miles. Wow. for the project as a whole, kind of broken up over the course of around 30 hours. So that was kind of fun. But really the big target I'm kind of heading for at this half of the year is in June. I should be going back to the Pettit Center where I ran the race that you were speaking about in the intro. And this time I'm going to be trying to see if I can solve the riddle of the 24-hour timed event. So I've taken a few shots at it, some of them kind of haphazardly, I would say, given the sort of kind of way I went about it maybe. But so this time I think I've learned enough through the mistakes to hopefully put up a number that is something I can build off of a little more specifically, because that is an event that I would like to try to get solved and I wouldn't say perfected, because I think when you're running for 24 hours, I don't know if there's such thing as perfection, but as close as one can hope for in terms of getting the most out of myself at that particular event. So hopefully June will give me a good foundation for that.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's incredible. I haven't done anything for 24 hours straight, let alone run. when you're going into an event like that for 24 hours, I know so many different wrenches are coming at you and you have to constantly adjust, but is the goal to kind of keep your pace about the same throughout? Meaning like you hold yourself back a little bit in the beginning and try to maintain that pace, or what's your strategy?
Yeah, it gets really interesting. Like if you look at historical data, it's probably skewed a little more towards like a positive split. So running a little slower at the end. We have some folks like Nick Curry, who's definitely kind of pioneered, I would say, like a fairly aggressive, even to negative split approach, which seems to work very well for him. You have the world record holder at the 24-hour distance, Sorokin, who he usually has a very slight positive split, which I'm kind of leaning towards as essentially being the recipe to, if you're to walk away and think to yourself, I couldn't have run this a second faster, or in the case of a distance, a timed event, I couldn't have gone a step further in that time frame. My thought is a very, 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 very slight positive split is probably going to be the number you'll see on the data at the end of it, because it kind of showcases that you didn't have enough slowdown to really be hemorrhaging time, but you also probably didn't leave anything on the table if you're just slowing down by a really small margin. And I want to say almost all of Sorokin's world records now, which span from 100K to 100 miles to 12 hours to 24 hours, all within like 18 months, is that slight positive split. So that's a kind of a compelling case study, I would say. And then you have Camille Herron, who has the women's world record, and hers are tend to be quite large positive splits, which may mean that she's got some improvements that she could make if she dials that in a little more tight in terms of how she's pacing it. For me personally, you know, I negative split to what was my the previous world record by about 2 minutes. My first 50 miles was 2 minutes fast, 2 minutes slower than my second 50 miles. So I do think like something around an even split is probably going to produce my best result. So the hard part when you get to 24 hours, especially when you're like me and I haven't really produced a very solid 24 hour race yet in my career, is picking what number do you build that even split off of. So it's like, you know, if you target the American record, which is 173 miles versus the world record, which is almost 193 miles, you know, you're, there's a pretty big spread there in terms of pacing, in terms of whether you want to go in there. And then you just have the relative like uncertainty of like what a good day even looks like for someone like myself who hasn't had a good day doing 24 hours. So there is still quite a bit of guesswork, but you know, that's one of the questions I hope to answer this June. Is I want to put up a big number, but I would love just as much as that is to put up a result that's consistent enough where I can start thinking about kind of whittling down where I want to set my sights on for some future attempts and just attempts and get that kind of just a little more precise. And that'll also help inform training too. Cause like with my training strategy, the last like 6 to 8 weeks of a buildup are typically spending a lot of time doing the intensity, the pace, the environment that I'm going to be seeing on race day. So that kind of data will be valuable for me, I think, if I can pull it out of this event.
Dude, I love that. So strategic. Absolutely love it. We'll definitely be cheering for you. We get asked constantly when we're coaching, you know, weekend warrior, especially like endurance athletes, people that are training for events. They are, you know, somewhat competitive. They want to do well with these. And, you know, they also have their normal life. These aren't professional athletes per se. They're just more, you know, the people that really love to do triathlon or marathons, half marathons, whatever endurance event they really like to do. And they ask us all the time about nutrition. And I don't know if you know, but the nutrition world can be quite confusing and people have a lot of ideas. And then when you throw this wrench into the plan of endurance sport, it's a whole nother ball game. It makes things, you know, in a way, I think a lot more complicated. So I would love to use this time with you to kind of create a guide for somebody that's maybe thinking about what they want to do as far as their fueling, not only during the event, but through their life to be able to help them with endurance sports. Before we start with that though, I'd love to kind of hear a brief version of your story and how nutrition became such a big part of something that you personally focused in.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, nutrition probably became something I was even willing to pay attention to somewhere in kind of my college years. So when I started to compete in track and cross country at the collegiate level, I started thinking more along the lines of, okay, there's the whole get out and doing the work and then doing the race, but there's also like, how do you fuel that? And, you know, I did what I think a lot of endurance athletes likely do, which is you turn to the literature and you turn to the resources of like, what does an endurance athlete eat? What do the elites eat? What does the recommendations suggest to eat, and start there. And so I did that. And it wasn't a massive deviation from a macronutrient standpoint from what I had been doing. It was just a little more dialing in, like maybe instead of, you know, a Snickers bar and Mountain Dew, like I would maybe do in high school, it was like, let's get that macronutrient profile from some more like nutrient dense options. So, you know, a lot of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, that sort of thing, was pretty standard. And I didn't really see any like massive, like deterrence from that while I was competing in college. And even for the, you know, few years after college, when I kind of continued on training on my own, as any compelling reason to maybe to switch that. So it was sort of an afterthought for the most part, as I kind of entered what I would consider my ultra marathon running career. Around 2011, I started getting a little more interested in targeting ultra marathon events as kind of the primary focus of what I wanted to kind of spend my race day energies on, and ended up doing 350 milers at the end of 2011. And, felt a little bit of the fatigue from that, I think, probably just as much from the training, you know, working a full-time job as a teacher while doing it and everything that kind of goes into that sort of a lifestyle. where I just wasn't having a lot of luck with having consistent energy levels throughout the course of the day. It seemed like, you know, if I woke up early in the morning to get my workout in, it was fine because it was the start of the day. I was relatively fresh. But when you go into work and things like that, I felt like I was just on a bit of a roller coaster from an energy standpoint. The other thing I maybe noticed that I'm not sure how this would have played out for sure, because I didn't actually test it because I hadn't done a 100-mile race yet. But of the 50 milers I had done, you know, I was taking in a pretty high amount of fuel, you know, upwards to 60, 70 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And, you know, I was pretty unconfident that I would be able to continue to do that for like hours and hours after the crossing of the finish line, so to speak, with these 50 mile races, which were generally, you know, being done around the 6 hour time frame for the courses I was racing on. So, I mean, that was a little bit of a concern. I wouldn't say that was something I was thinking about in a ton of detail at the time. I was more interested in just like my energy levels and the relative sustainability of what I was doing. So being new to the sport, enjoying endurance, not wanting to necessarily scale back on the training I was doing or the race frequency and things like that, I decided to kind of manipulate diet first and see what that would do for me, if anything. So at around that same time, I had got kind of familiar with some of the Dr. Stephen Finney and Dr. Jeff Volek literature and stuff on low carbohydrate and specifically like ketogenic diets and things like that. So, you know, fortunately for me, I was able to talk to them and other folks who were kind of working alongside them or was at least in the know of it about kind of what a good way to maybe try it out would be versus just what I see sometimes, which is like, oh, you know, I'm 5 weeks out from my race. I don't think this is working. I should do a complete 180 on my nutrition, which rarely works well. I think a lot of times if you're going to make a significant dietary shift, the off season is the best time to do it. It gives you a little bit more time to like authentically explore how you're going to feel. It allows you to kind of ease back into training and test out how it's going to work throughout various phases of training versus whether it's going to work in like your peaking phase versus, you know, your base building phase or something like that. So I was really fortunate in that I, you know, was able to do it during an off season. I spent about 4 weeks doing a pretty strict ketogenic diet. I was running, but it was unstructured. It was off season. So it was like, if I felt like running, I wasn't going to like not do it. But if I didn't feel like running, I'd take a day off. Or if I felt like running short, not long, I would run short. And you know, it was kind of an interesting 4 weeks because I would have days where I felt basically the same as I always did on the runs and other days where I was running a fair bit slower at the same intensity. The thing that really kept me interested though, was my just energy levels outside of running and my sleep quality improved. Which is the sleep quality one is interesting to me because the consistent energy level seems to be something that pans out for a lot larger percentage of the people who go with a lower carbohydrate approach. So that wasn't too big of a surprise to me. The sleep quality one is a bit of a bigger surprise at the time, maybe not so much because I just didn't know what I didn't know. But I think I see just as many people have that reverse effect where, you know, they try taking on a low carbohydrate ketogenic approach and their sleep quality suffers. So for whatever reason, mine was improved by it. And those two things were very compelling in terms of trying to make it sustainable. Then it was just like, well, what do I do with this once I introduce structured training? Does it work? Does it not work? Do I have to make changes? Do I have to go back to what I was doing before? Is there a middle ground here? And as I kind of went through like a few seasons of building up from off season to peak training to racing and then kind of repeating that process, I started coming up with like a formula that I felt worked quite well for myself, where it wasn't a strict ketogenic diet throughout the course of the year. It was maybe a strict ketogenic diet on the off season. But then once I start getting into structured training, I start kind of adjusting those carbohydrate numbers up a little bit higher to accommodate the extra energy expenditure that someone like myself is going to go through. So like, you know, on a big training day, I might burn 2-3 times my resting metabolic rate. That's going to look different than someone who is, you know, burning essentially their resting metabolic rate on a strict ketogenic diet. So there was a lot of exploration in that first year and a half or so before I feel like I had a system that was going to work well for me and support my training and racing the way I wanted it to. And yeah, I haven't seen a reason for it to not be the case since then. So I've been doing it now for, I guess about 11 years. What is it? 2000.
Wow.
Yeah. So in this fall will be 11 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. No, I really appreciate that explanation. I'm glad that you went through all of that to just to be able to, you know, share with the listener how much experience you have with all of this. Not only are you very successful, but you've tried all of these different nutritional strategies. And it's funny, you go back to like when you were getting going, when I was racing bikes, like there wasn't multiple strategies. There was one strategy. You did what endurance athletes do, which means you eat oatmeal and pasta and bread, and you supplement with goos and gels and the sports drinks and the gas station stops for the double chocolate grandma's cookies would be the only way I could get through like a 3-hour ride back in the day. Now there seems to be other options and other ways that we can do this, which is great. People can choose what they want. And I don't know about you, but in my mind, I would very generally classify those as the two major kind of strategies. I'm going to do endurance sport on a higher carbohydrate, lower fat diet, or I'm going to do endurance sport on a higher fat, moderate fat, but definitely lower carbohydrate approach. Would you agree with that? Do you think pretty much every strategy can fit into one of those two buckets very generally?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably even some more middle ground. I think a lot of the triathletes maybe in the 80s were experimenting a little bit from time to time with like a, I guess what you'd call like a 40-30-30 strategy. So you're getting a little more kind of just even across the board with that. I think if people are going to look at it from the individual level, the way I like to kind of describe it is when you start getting into like these longer endurance events where you have a scenario in which there's a high, if not inevitable, likelihood that you're going to deplete your muscle glycogen far enough where it's going to negatively impact performance. The goal for everyone at that point is defending muscle glycogen. Now, how you do it is going to depend on the individual and depend on their goals, their dietary practices, their training program, everything that kind of goes into that. But, defending muscle glycogen on race day is what you need to be able to do in order to have a successful day. So I find it rare that people can defend muscle glycogen in an optimal way and still reach peak performance for them at the individual level following a relatively strict ketogenic diet. I've seen it in the sense that I've seen people PR with things like the marathon or ultra marathons on a strict ketogenic diet. Probably there's a unique combination of variables to them as an individual that produces that. I would say most folks, and this is where I think looking at the elite athletes or the professionals is really interesting, because they tend to have less variables to deal with because they've built their life around training for a specific distance, a specific race. So they're going to try to eliminate variables that are going to negatively impact it, that are going to get in the way from that. So they maybe have a little bit more of a narrow path forward. You have that type of situation, and now all of a sudden, I think it probably limits a little more specifically what you can do to reach your max potential versus like the average person who's going to, you know, train for a couple marathons a year, but they're also going to work their job. They're also going to raise their family. They're also going to have their social activities and things where they're doing. And you know, that just introduces a ton of other variables that are already going to pull them away from ever getting to their maximum potential because they're just not living like a monk training for a race. and I think sometimes that stuff adds flavor to your life and ultimately can help you produce a faster time in some cases. I think we're seeing this in some case with marathoning right now. Actually, there's a lot more professionals who have things going on outside of the training and racing, and they're producing good results because of it to some degree. But I mean, obviously like having to wake up 2 hours earlier than your body really wants you on a frequent basis, you know, having a kid that's crying at 2 a.m. and things like that. These are all going to be things that are going to be like make the average person a little less comparable to say like the elite athlete. So I think context is huge there. I would say just in the general rhetoric that you see to kind of answer your question, it does seem like people are kind of a little more black and white about it, where it's like carbs good, fats bad, fats good, carbs bad. And that's kind of the end of it. And then they just argue amongst themselves. But you know, usually when I talk to people who have either explored this professionally or explored this from like a layman's standard, like I would consider myself being, you know, I'm an endurance athlete. I'm not a PhD in nutrition or a dietitian or anything like that. You're going to see a lot more, I think, middle ground a lot of times. You're going to see a lot less dogma in terms of like, you know, like I don't see carbs as a negative. They just make up a smaller percentage of my diet than fat does. So when carbohydrates are going to help me improve and not have any deleterious effects, then, you know, I'm going to lean into them when I need to, if it's going to produce a faster time. That may be unique to this type of sport I'm doing. I mean, context is everything with this question. So like 100 miles, something that's going to take me between 11 and 12 hours on a very controlled flat surface, That's a lot different than say something like a marathon done at a low 2 hour framework or something like those are like completely different events done at completely different intensities and likely different skill sets too. If we're probably getting into like all the details.
Yeah, no, that's great. Context is so critical to consider. And you're right. Like if you look at a professional athlete, when they're in high training levels, like most people don't understand, they're either training or they are horizontal. Like they lay down, they don't even like to walk or do anything besides take in a massive amount of calories, recover, sleep, massage, all those things so they can perform at that highest level. And we see them performing at the highest level. And so we think, wow, that's the sexy part. That's the fun part. I'm going to get after it on the weekend. But we don't realize like, well I just worked 50 hours and I did have the screaming kid and woke up a bunch of times. Like there's a lot of other different things to consider as far as context goes. I do want to, I guess we can kind of start with, let's talk about the person who is the kind of more general, they are going to be training for endurance events. They're not necessarily a professional athlete, but they do want to consider switching over to a lower carbohydrate type approach, at least in their diet, as far as their like day-to-day goes, especially in the off season where I agree. I think it's the most beneficial. What are the sort of pros and cons to changing from a more traditional, like higher carbohydrate is going to fuel me, to more of a lower carbohydrate. And I want to be more, you know, fat adapted, if you want to call it metabolically efficient. What are some of the pros and cons of doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's going to probably depend a little bit on what is working and what's not working. So if you get someone who like, let's say I have a coaching client come to me and they're like, I'm curious in doing a low carbohydrate approach. I'm going to ask them why, because if they say like, oh, I have massive digestive issues when I'm racing, I hate training my gut to be able to tolerate what I would need to take in during, you know, a race. I've gotten my fat oxidation tests done and it's like, I'm clearly not able to eat enough to supplement what I need to do to defend muscle glycogen, or, you know, maybe it's a preference thing. Maybe they're just like, I feel like I'm hungry all the time when I'm following this and I can't control my appetite. And I'm, you know, like the average person likely has to think about things like that. They don't have this endless furnace like some of the pros do, where they're just like, there's more is always better. You know, they also have to consider like, you know, how much energy do I need to take in to sustain this lifestyle, but also, you know, not overdo it too. So, you know, I like to explore as to like why they're doing it before I start saying like, you know, maybe you should try this or something else. You know, a lot of times where I think like we make a whole lot of commotion about it, that they really don't need to be making a lot of commotion about it, is by leaning on what the person's done in the past. So, I mean, take me for example, like it's not like I was, you know, born doing a low carbohydrate diet and then developed this ideology because it's been what I've been familiar with my whole life and have never even tried using a moderate to high carbohydrate approach. You know, that's what I started with. And I think that's just where most people are going to be. It's pretty rare, I think, that the average coach gets someone coming to them and there's like, oh, I've been on a low carbohydrate ketogenic diet for the last 2 years. You know, don't try to get me off of it. I don't care what your research says. I think most people are coming to these coaches and saying what you said, which is, I'm curious about trying this, or where's the application here? So I think when people are being honest with the conversation, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, there's going to be some advantages and disadvantages no matter what you do. The advantages of staying moderate to high carbohydrate is you're going to be able to have access to a very fast acting fuel source. And, you know, if you can make that work right, it's going to potentially produce a faster race time if the race is short enough where the intensity is high enough that it is going to, that you're going to need something as fast acting as a carbohydrate source. You know, another advantage, maybe that might just be the foods you prefer to eat. I find like when it comes to picking a diet, it's less about whether like you're following the dietary guidelines or whether you're vegan or whether you're carnivore or ketogenic, you know, whatever one you want to pick. It's more about, is this something that you enjoy enough and you can do almost intuitively enough that you almost can, once you kind of get it organized, you start kind of just being able to kind of do it without thinking too much about it. Because I think that's where people find the most success, when they're not overthinking what they're doing. They're not loathing what they're doing. They're not forcing themselves to eat things they don't like and avoiding things that they enjoy because it's not on the list of approved foods and that sort of thing. So I think like just finding something that works for you. And I haven't found any reason to believe there's any one diet that is going to be universal with that. So yeah, that's where I'm going to lean on the person to kind of like share with what they enjoy to eat, what they feel like they can stick to. And I get a pretty wide variety of different results with that. I've had I have folks who come to me and they're like, I'm doing moderate carbohydrate right now. You know, they have enough reasons to potentially want to switch to a low carbohydrate diet. They try it and it works great for them. And we just keep on going. I've had folks where we try it. It's, you know, it's not working as well. And we kind of inch them way right back to where they were before. But in that process, they find some groups of foods and some things that they really do enjoy that they can stay consistent with. So now they're following a similar macronutrient profile they were before, but now they just have a little more precise individual structuring of that in order to better, you know, stay consistent with it and not hit the pitfalls that they did in the past. In terms of like a low carbohydrate diet, where the advantage there is going to be, especially it's just going to get more applicable as you move up in the distance or the time you're spending out there. So the big one that stands out is when you're eating less carbohydrates, your body is forced to have higher fat oxidation rates. You know, you can manipulate fat oxidation rates outside of diet as well, but the bigger mover, the biggest mover, I should say, is going to be replacing carbohydrates with fat. And if you can lower your ratios of carbs to fats at various intensities, and your race intensity is low enough where you can defend muscle glycogen with more fat than you were before, now all of a sudden you're in a framework where you don't need as many gels, as many sports products and things like that in order to get from the start to the finish with adequately defended muscle glycogen. So take me, for example. You know, I was moderate to high carbohydrate when I first started in order to get to the finish line, feeling like I was able to really push. You know, I'm hitting 60 plus grams of carbohydrate per hour. You know, now that I'm lower carbohydrate, it's more like 30 to 40. So from a digestive standpoint, I'm able to minimize by almost half what I was taking in before, which just is going to put me in a position to probably have less potential to having a gastrointestinal issue. Now, if I would go strict ketogenic diet, that's where it gets interesting, I think, from just like the counter argument as to where some weaknesses are with that. So you have a scenario there where you are continuing to improve your fat oxidation rates, but the question then becomes to what degree and at what expense. And the expense in that scenario is likely going to be your ability to actually utilize an exogenous carbohydrate in a meaningful amount. So if I go strict keto for like say half a year and then try to do a race, I may no longer be able to tolerate even 30 to 40 grams of carbohydrate per hour. So I have to hope that the distance and the intensity is great, or the distance is great enough and the intensity is low enough that I can get away with just sticking to a strict ketogenic diet. And I think there is some application there when you get into these really longer events, or you get into events where there is like a lot of self-support and you're reliant on carrying your own fuel and things like that. But for something like I'm doing, you know, I'm still going to be, let's say we'll take my 1900 mile, for example. I had my fat oxidation rates tested before that event. And the numbers indicated that I was going to need somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20% of my fuel, of the energy I was burning that day from carbohydrate at the pace I wanted to target. So looking at those numbers, you know, that meant that I was going to want to get in 30 to 40 grams of carbohydrate per hour in order to defend that. And, you know, that's kind of why I picked those numbers. You know, that it wasn't just like a nebulous number that showed up. It was like based on those tests I've gotten. And, you know, so if I had gone in and my fat oxidation rates suggested that I needed those numbers, but I could only manage to digest and process 20 grams, I'm going to have the same problem as I would have if I was moderate carbohydrate and my fat oxidation rates weren't high enough for me to defend muscle glycogen, or my digestion became an issue because I overshot what I was able to tolerate from a gastrointestinal standpoint. So like these are the things I think that most people are thinking about with it. They're thinking about just what's the relative sustainability of their nutrition approach. Like, is it something they can stick to and they can enjoy enough where it becomes intuitive? And is it going to produce the experience on race day that they're looking for? Is it going to get them to the finish line without having too much gastrointestinal issues where their end result gets sabotaged by that? Is it going to give them the opportunity to where they can defend muscle glycogen enough where they're able to be strong and maybe even faster at the end of the race versus feeling like the wheels are coming off or like they're bonking at the end of a race?
That is super, super well explained. And I feel like we could have ended the podcast after you said, find the diet that has the foods that you enjoy, that you like, you can be consistent with. Anything else that we talk about in this podcast is probably way less of a priority than that. I think that's super important. And I'm really, really glad that you pointed that out. If you're right, like if you gave me a shopping list of a bunch of crap that I don't like and I think is really gross, like I'm not going to stay on that diet regardless.
Yeah, you might ride it out for a training cycle and then nail a race, but then inevitably, if it's not sustainable, it's not going to be reproducible for you. So unless you're in it for like one big go, then it's like that wasn't a long-term solution for you. And I think you're right. I think like outside of like possibly like the, you know, like Olympians, they're like the elites of the sports, you're at a point where like picking a diet where you're most likely to be able to stick to and you enjoy is going to be the more meaningful long-term solution in most cases.
Yeah. Free of a lot of the processed crap and the stuff we know we need to be avoiding anyway. I love that. No, that's great. I wonder if you think differently about the genders, male versus female. Do they need to be eating similarly or do they need to be on vastly different programs as far as nutrition goes for endurance sports?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's going to be some variances. Specifically around like menstrual cycles and things like that for women. And I think even that becomes an interesting question because you're going to have like one person respond maybe differently than the other person. There's going to be like the population averages, but there's going to be the outliers that, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't impact as negatively or it impacts way worse than average. They're going to be even more mindful about it and things like that. So there's probably like some indication that there would be some differences, but really, I think based on what we know, or you could look at it the other way too, is like what we don't know is you're going to kind of still have to follow a similar roadmap, whether you're male or female, which is, again, do I enjoy the foods I'm eating enough where I'm going to be able to sustain having them? Are they supporting the activity I'm trying to do? So in other words, is my performance indicative of what my nutrition supporting it or deterring it? And these are all questions you're going to ask whether you're male or female. There may be some discrepancy or some differences on how, like what percentage of people would end up kind of following a specific path from the genders, but I don't know for sure, like if that's been teased out thoroughly or not. I'm sure there's some difference whether we know it or not is above my pay grade, so to speak. So like when people ask me about that, or when I have a coaching client specifically who is, you know, a male versus a female, I'm not as concerned about whether, you know, the population averages from one to the next with that type of thing. I'm more interested in, is this going to, or like when we do it, if they're like convinced they want to try it, you know, I get a little bit of a range. I have some people who are just like curious and they want me to kind of share what I've seen from the folks I've worked with, as well as like maybe what we know and don't know. And then they can make a decision if they want to try it or not. Versus someone who's like committed to trying it and they just want me to help them eliminate as many of the potential pitfalls that are going to come along the way when you kind of revamp your diet the way you're going to if you switch from a moderate to high carbohydrate diet to a lower carbohydrate diet or even a ketogenic style diet. So either way, I think we're going to be looking at like what the priorities are. Is the performance or the priorities heading in the direction we're looking for it to? If yes, then we can kind of keep going on and making adjustments as needed, or this isn't working. We need to kind of reevaluate the strategy and, you know, figure out what is going to work for you at the individual level versus, you know, what we thought would work or what is suggested to work on the data we do have.
Yeah, that's a great answer as well. There's somebody who I've listened to their content before, and they talk about women specifically in endurance and fueling and so many things. I just absolutely could not agree more with protecting muscle mass, so critical, making sure you're getting plenty of protein, so critical, especially as we age, we get more anabolic resistant. It's just so critical. And so many of these things, I'm like listening to the content and nodding along and like, yes, this is great. I love this stuff. And then to hear like for women, a low carbohydrate diet and also intermittent fasting doesn't work. That will never work. It works for maybe like a few weeks, but then it always fails. And these people are not getting enough energy. And so because they're not getting enough energy, they're now really catabolic and they're losing muscle tissue and they're way overstressed all the time. And I don't know. My experience just that it's kind of like it's like a sharp note. It just doesn't like really connect with me. That hasn't been my experience coaching women as far as diet goes. I would be really curious to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I'd be curious as to one, what is the data on men versus women in having issues with relative energy deficit in the first place, irregardless of whether it's a carbohydrate or a fat. So like if I'm working with a person who's chronically under eating you know, does it matter if they're under eating on carbohydrates or under eating on fats? The outcome is going to be similar. They're going to eventually, it's not going to be sustainable. Their performance is going to suffer and they're not going to be able to stick with what they're going to do or meet the goals they're suggesting or they're trying to meet. You know, is it possible that one could potentially be more catastrophic than the other? You know, then you ask yourself is, would you rather have it, you fail on it soon enough so you can make a change quicker, or have it be a gradual decline where at the end you look back thinking, well, it worked for 2 years. Why isn't it working now? Which I think we see a lot of times with eating disorders and women in endurance sport is it worked for a year or two, but then it doesn't. But they cling to that year or two where it did work when it's not reproducible or sustainable past that. So like, I think like those are probably like data points that we need to kind of include in order to really answer that question. Yeah, I mean, I just think there's going to be a range between whether a person responds to a lower carbohydrate diet for those symptoms that you explained, independent of whether they're male or female. Like I've worked with men who they try going lower carb and they have that same outcome where they feel more irritable, they feel like their energies dip, they feel like their legs are super heavy. You know, sometimes it's just about kind of recalibrating where they place themselves within low carb. Because one time, I mean, it's like we've talked about before, like people think like low carb keto are interchangeable and it's essentially an elimination of carbohydrate, but really low carbohydrate could be anything. It could be as much as 30% of your diet, even maybe 40% of your diet coming from carbohydrate. And it would still be from the literature considered a low carbohydrate diet. So it's like, if you have a terrible experience with 5% of your energy coming from carbohydrate, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're gonna have that same experience at 30%. So maybe walk your way up and see if you hit a stride along the way versus completely going back to the other side of the equation or the other side of the spectrum is the way I like to do it. That's how I did with myself. And that's how I've found the most success with people who are interested enough to try it. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to kind of unpack with that one. And whether it's a unique thing to women versus men, I don't know for sure. I would say from the research I have seen, I feel like on average, women actually have higher fat oxidation rates than men when everything else is held constant. So similar macronutrient profiles, similar lifestyles and things like that. So, I mean, that would suggest that if anything, there were maybe more, I guess you could look at it two different ways. They have more potential with that, but you could also make the argument that they have less of a need to because they're going to produce higher fat oxidation rates with similar carbohydrate intake. So it may be, you know, I guess it depends on how you kind of, or what lens you look at that through.
Yeah. Well, that was exactly the point that they were making. I'm so glad you mentioned that. They were saying like, yes, women have a better profile to oxidize fat. And so thus like intermittent fasting won't work for women or again, the blanket low carb just flat won't work. And that's where I was a little confused by it. And you know, you hear them talking about like what a day in the life is of eating. And it's like meal, snack, meal, snack, meal, snack, meal, snack. And basically always eating all the time. And I think about, you know, some of my clients who do endurance sport and they really appreciate something like intermittent fasting, where they're not that hungry in the morning. They can go on a run or a bike ride or whatever, and they don't need to eat before, and they don't feel like they're hungry all the time. And I'm wondering how somebody hearing that would think like, well, dang, like I really like to do intermittent fasting, but if it's never going to work for me and in 4 weeks, I'm going to be gaining fat and getting bloated all the time. I couldn't make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people just have, I mean, it's like anything too. It's like, you know, some people can, you know, have a glass of wine at night and not think twice about a second glass. And then other people, if they have one glass of wine, it's like off to the races. You know, there's going to be a range in how people like respond to, you know, any of this stuff. So like your example with intermittent fasting, I think is a really interesting one because I've worked with clients in the past before too, where it's like, we decide, okay, maybe intermittent fasting at a population level is going to be counterproductive for your specific lifestyle. So let's try including breakfast first thing in the morning. Well, they wake up, they're not hungry, they force feed themselves breakfast. And they get to the end of the day thinking, I'm going to be less ravenous because I added those calories in the beginning of the day. And they get to dinner and they're just as hungry and they eat just as much. And now they're sitting on a 500 to 700 calorie surplus above what they were having before. And if this person specifically is trying to lose weight for the right reasons, and that could create a scenario in which at the individual level, that person is just not going to respond to the lifestyle of eating breakfast first thing in the morning. So, you know, I think it gets really interesting when you get down to just like the personalities, the, the individual aspect of it versus the population data. I mean, I don't think it's bad to say like, hey, this is what the, and this is what I like to do is like, this is what the position paper, or this is what the data suggests on average will happen. Whether you fall into that is going to be, it's going to be like a percentage base. So it's like, I won't know until we explore whether that person is actually going to fall within that or not. Some things are going to be more powerful than others with higher percentages of the population that respond a specific way. And with those cases, I think it's probably a little easier to solve because, you know, you have, let's say you have a 95% chance that something is going to work a specific way for everybody. Well, it's pretty rare you're going to run across one of the 5% people.
Right.
If it's like a 60% though, you know, now we're looking at almost a coin flip's chance. So it gets really interesting at that point. And that's where I think like lifestyle, again, what we were talking about before, and this includes intermittent fasting and all this other stuff, where it's got to be something that you find both enjoyable and helps you get to where you want to get versus what your neighbor wants to get to or your friend wants to get to. So, I mean, because just like, you know, I've had people too, where like, you know, they want to do intermittent fasting because they think it's going to be this like, this great, like, add in for them, and it's going to solve a bunch of issues that they're dealing with. And then they try it and, you know, their performance tanks, their energy tanks, their sleep gets disrupted and things like that. And we're like, well, clearly that wasn't the answer for you. So maybe you fall within the population of people who shouldn't be kind of implementing that strategy. But I think when you back up and just look at all these things as tools and potential options to play with, and you consider your lifestyle, your own preferences, your goals, and your relative curiosity to try any of this stuff, you know, that's where you start to kind of get to answers that are kind of fun to explore and worthwhile, in my opinion.
I really appreciate that answer versus saying like something flat just won't work, period. Like,
yeah,
lots of different things can work. They can be tools. There's also arguments about like balance in your diet, and like sugar isn't bad for you. And if you have a little bit of sugar in your diet, that's not going to be detrimental. And it's like, I'm sitting here like, yeah, you're right. But who, like, I envy the person who can have a little bit of sugar. I know that I can't. And I know a lot of other people that really can't. And if they do, they need more and more and more and more. And they have a really tough time as far as moderation. I love the idea of moderation. I just can't get it to work for myself and a lot of my clients if they don't have that type of mindset, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I know I love Lane Norton's explanation of this. He gets some heat from everyone essentially at certain points, depending on like who's like stretching outside of where the research would indicate. But what he says is like, you have to work within the parameters of what's going to work for you. There's going to be some universal truths. Like if you consume more energy than you are burning, then you are going to add weight. If you consume less energy than you are burning, then you are going to lose weight, which makes sense, I think. But then how you get to those points are going to be individual. So like for himself, he's the type of person, he can open up a big bag of M&Ms and have 8 of them and be like, okay, that's how many M&Ms I need to support my goals for the day. I hit that urge to eat that sweet thing. Now I'm back to, you know, being productive. Whereas his wife is different. You know, she opens up that bag of M&Ms. She's not eating 8. She's eating the whole bag. So if that whole bag of M&Ms doesn't fit within her goals, then that's a bad move for her to even open the thing in the first place. She needs to pick something else that's going to help her meet her needs or get her to where she's trying to get to.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I always like, I'd see him be on these like debates, and he'd be like debating these people in low carbohydrate world. And it's like, if you listen to what he's saying, it's very much in line with anybody in the low carbohydrate space. And the recent episode he did on Peter Attia, I thought was phenomenal. Really well explained, very reasonable. You know, I know he likes to stir the chili a little bit, but I don't think he ever really says much that's incorrect. I think he does a wonderful job talking about nutrition.
Yeah. And I think he's against absolutes. So like he's going to be very, very poignant, I think, when it comes to like, if someone says like, you know, like sugar is inherently bad for you or fat is inherently bad for you. It's like, no, the dosage makes the poison, and the individual's ability to control or manipulate the way they kind of go about that is going to be the real driver with that. So, yeah, I mean, I really like his stuff. I think he's got options for basically anyone's preference. And if you're getting the goals you're looking for within that, I think he's got some actionable tools for just about everyone. So it's almost like he's almost in a place where like everyone's going to either hate him or love him depending on how they look at it. If they look at it as like, these are all options, I need to find the one that works for me, they're probably going to love him. If they look at it as, this is my approach, it works better for everybody and they just need to learn it, they're probably going to hate him.
Totally. Yeah. That's a really good way to explain that. So let's transition now from the person again, who, you know, they decide they're going to go from a high carbohydrate, maybe standard American, to a lower carbohydrate diet. This is the off season. Now their training's ramping up. We have, you know, your A races, B races, C races, as far as priority goes, you're starting to approach some of those A races. Let's say it's 2-3 months out. Now is where we're including, you know, heavier training, higher volume, most likely higher intensity, most likely. Now this person, let's say they've been on that lower carbohydrate diet, they're more fat adapted. They're able to use more fat as fuel. What are some things that person wants to be thinking about strategically as they're starting to ramp that intensity and volume up and wanting to include more carbohydrates to help for fuel as they're getting up to the race?
Yeah, I think this is where the race distance is probably going to be a pretty big driver in the answer to that. So like if they're hitting like, if you take like a marathon training plan, you're going to have that phase right before the race itself where you're still doing enough intensity, like at least moderate intensity type stuff. And then you're probably hitting like peak mileage at the same time. So it's a pretty unique combination. You take someone like myself running a 100-miler, at that point in their training, I'm dropping a lot of the intensity, almost all of it, in favor of having extra volume, extra training load going towards running the pace that I'll be doing on race day, which tends to be lower because I'm running all day. Just makes sense, right? So, you know, for that, it's going to be maybe a little bit different. I think like usually what I look at is, regardless of whether you're doing the marathon or the 100 miles, I think there is going to be application for doing like a variety of different intensities in your training. So like, you know, for me, I might do short intervals earlier in my training plan because it's least specific to my race pace, but it's still going to help me kind of lift up the ceiling or the potential I'm going to have at my race pace if I go through a full adaptation period of that and then move more specifically to what I'll be doing on race day. You know, so for me, like I might increase my carbohydrate during that phase of training, whereas someone training for like a 5K or a 10K may do that more near the end as they're working on the specifics that they're going to use on race day. Really, what I think where it gets interesting is more about like getting away from this mindset of like, this is what I eat each day and every day, and it's going to be in these exact macronutrient ratios, is more about like, how do I position my carbohydrate, and this is maybe a little more specific to the lower carb group, but how do I kind of maximize my usage of carbohydrate without going so far away from low carb that now I'm back into the moderate high carb category if they find that that's not a useful like place for them to be from a lifestyle standpoint. So for those folks, I like to look at it as like, well, let's say we're doing 2 short interval sessions this week. Let's congest, or let's look at your weekly intake versus your daily intake. And say, like, if you want to stay roughly around these ranges of carbohydrate or these percentages of carbohydrate, you can do that every day, or you can flex it way up on those 2 days when you're doing those fast interval sessions. And then you can flex well below that on the days where you're doing a rest day or an easy recovery run or something that's going to be a lot less glycolytic. And then I think you start to kind of find a little bit more of a best of both worlds where you're defending muscle glycogen, you're able to kind of hit those faster, harder workouts. But you're not necessarily like from a grand scheme of things, changing your overall percentages of macronutrient intake as drastically as you would. So I think what you end up having a lot of times with folks where they are on a moderate to high carbohydrate diet is they end up fueling efforts that could be done with more fat with carbohydrate. So they find themselves in this position where they're eating so much carbohydrate because they know they need some of it, but they're taking that instead of risking not getting enough, they're just skewing away some of their fat metabolism in favor of that. And there's some events where that may be beneficial for. I think like elite marathoning is probably the best example of that. Or if you're someone who's not an elite marathoner, but you're pretty dedicated in training for like your personal best at a half marathon or something that's going to be roughly 2 hours in duration or something like that. So again, a lot of context required to really nail down that question. But I think getting away from thinking of it as like exact same thing every day, day in, day out, and more of like, well, how does my day-to-day change? Because endurance athletes have this unique lifestyle where you know, one day may be incredibly energy expensive or very high intensity, and the next day may be the exact opposite of that.
Yeah. I think it's so smart to think of it that way, is like, yeah, I'm using more energy. I've stayed mostly lower carbohydrate. I can still stay mostly lower carbohydrate. I'm just not going to go back up to doing, you know, 400 grams a day. Maybe I have some extra rice and a sweet potato one day and some extra fruit, you know, before or after a workout, without getting to be like, you know, back to, you know, very high carbohydrate diet that they were on before. I think that's a really good way to kind of manage that. As far as that person, again, really well fat adapted on race day, how should they be thinking about their nutrition as well to be able to get that, you know, boost from the carbohydrates on that specific day? Because again, like I worked most of my career on a metabolic cart. And so we were doing fat oxidation measurements all the time. And if somebody was high carbohydrate, you knew this says you're burning 800 calories of carbohydrate per hour. I know you store about 2000. So our strategy is I'm going to try to stuff as much carbohydrate as you can digest, 200, 300. Let's try to train that and get that up. And that's our strategy. And see if you can beat the bonk, because it's going to come at some point. For somebody who's on the other side of things, more low carbohydrate, on race day itself, how would they think about fueling, especially for, let's say, those longer events? So past 2 hours, let's say 3, 4, 5+ hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're going to, in a perfect scenario, they're going to have the same scenario as your high carbohydrate individual. They're going to have those fat oxidation tests done, and they're going to be able to determine, like, within reason, what types of macronutrient ratios they're going to be, or basically carbs and fats that they're going to be burning at the intensity they're planning on racing. So, you know, you get the high carbohydrate person, you know, they might be like a 70-30 or something like that at race intensity. And then where you just get the lower carbohydrate person might be like, you know, 40-60 or something like that. So it's going to just be, you're going to use the same protocol where you're looking at, well, how many carbohydrates per hour are you going to be metabolizing given your current diet and training on race day? And what do we need to have you consume in order to defend that? You know, you get into like 5-6 hour range, you're starting to push closer to lower intensity. I think like you can 5 hours, you can still push into moderate intensity for at least some of that in a lot of cases, depending on kind of how the fitness is developed in the individual and what their target is and all that stuff. But generally speaking, I think like you're going to still have those same protocols. It's just going to be different numbers that get spit out by the machine. It's a lot of people aren't going to go and get a metabolic cart test, and they're going to still have that question. They're going to wonder, well, what do I do? This is where I think like you, if you're already low carb, if that's your approach, it's working well for you, you've been doing it for a long enough time where you're willing to trust it on race day and things like that. I find most of the folks I'm working with do quite well with the 30 to 40 grams per hour target. I actually asked this question to Matt Carpenter, who's been doing some research on low carbohydrate endurance athletes, because I love talking to him about this, because he's not necessarily like, oh, this has got to be the path forward and I need to study it. He's like, his general attitude is like, clearly people are going to try this. So if people are going to try this, we need to find the best path forward for them, so that when they do it, we have some potential options for them, some starting points, and then they can, you know, at least get close with their first attempt. So you're not playing so much trial and error where you find yourself on race day not having any answers because nothing was clear at the end of it all. And he suggested that most of the folks that come through his lab that are on a low carbohydrate diet are going to be anywhere from 30 to 45 grams per hour, I believe is what he said when I asked him that.
Nice. Yeah, that's not bad. And that's where the value of training, it's just so important on those last kind of big, you know, training runs or rides or whatever, those big workouts before the event. That's your proving ground. That's the place to test things out. And I don't know about you, but the temptation for me that always backfired would be like the day before a race, I'm like, okay, I've used these single caffeinated whatever gels. Ooh, but look at this one. This one's double caffeinated. I'm going to try this tomorrow and I'm going to get double the boost. And you realize you get double the, you know, gastrointestinal problems or whatever. Like you really need to kind of sort this stuff out in your training so that you have most of that done before race day, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's also like, I mean, there's going to be some variance between the field and the lab. And that's where I think like, even if you do have those fat oxidation tests, it's probably still worth, you know, testing it out in the field before you do it on a race day. Or if you don't have access to a lab, you could do like these field tests that I think are going to be fairly informative at least. And the one I like is, especially if I'm working with ultra marathoners and we're doing like you know, we're really starting to develop their long run. Well, I might send them out for that long run with just water and electrolytes if they're a low carb individual. And if they come back and they're like, yeah, I felt pretty even the whole way, didn't feel like my energy levels dipped, you know, maybe I haven't felt better at the end than I did at the beginning. If they're reporting back with that after a 3-4, maybe 5-hour long run, then I'm not really concerned about their fat oxidation rates at that point. Now I'm concerned about, okay, now on race day, you're going to be going double, triple that time frame. So you may not get that same exact experience if you just do that whole race with water and electrolytes. So now, since we can suspect that you're going to want some carbohydrate, let's start playing around with the foods you're going to eat during the race itself. Personally, I think there's a good application for ultra marathoners is like a split between kind of these sports products and some solid foods, just to kind of help with the digestion side of things like that. But then you have that opportunity once you've kind of confirmed with your field test that you're fat adapted enough to start practicing what you'll do on race day, confirm that a certain thing is going to sit in your stomach the way you want it to, confirm that you don't mind eating this in the heat, or, you know, really start to whittle down like what your go-to options are going to be. And then it's just what I like to do is have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C, and go between your plan A and plan B for the most part, and then have that plan C available in case for whatever reason the stuff that you thought were going to work perfectly in training decide not to work on some odd, you know, race out there. It's pretty rare, but you also get these races that are long enough too, where you start getting kind of like a little bit of palate fatigue. So if your plan A and plan B start getting boring enough, you might look at an aid station and be like, that looks good, I'm going to grab that. And that's kind of like where we start to look at, like, as a plan C side of the equation.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder if, you know, last question, maybe we could ask you a little bit about some of the products that you mentioned. Is there a grouping of products, either type or brand or something, where, you know, at least if that person is in this ballpark, they're going to be in, you know, in the right ballpark enough to be able to dial in, you know, individually. And this could be, you know, any one of your sponsors. We've liked using Generation UCAN in the past. I know, I believe you still use S Fuels. You know, are those inherently better than something like Gatorade and Goo? I mean, don't mean to throw any brands under the bus, but is there any place that, you know, like, okay, if this person is in this area, they're going to be okay?
Yeah. I mean, I use S Fuels Race Plus as my carbohydrate sports product during races. And I like it because it is formulated in a way that it's going to be maybe a little more friendly on digestion. I mean, when you look at some of these sports products like gels, Gatorades, and things like that, they're almost too good at what they do when you start getting into like these really long events. And that's for good reason. They were formulated for shorter endurance events. They weren't formulated necessarily for ultra marathoners. So you have this unique scenario where, like, you have a relatively low intensity on race day and you have this product that is like supposed to kick in immediately. So if you overshoot that, then you're going to have a scenario where your body's likely going to pump fluid into your digestive tract in order to kind of slow that process down. And that's where you're going to get some of these digestion or these gastrointestinal issues. So like the reason I like Race Plus is because it does have small amounts of fat and protein in it. Not enough to make it like an extra thing to digest that you don't really need, but enough to kind of ease the digestion a little bit there. For people who aren't looking, let's say someone decided they found a product they really like, and they're like, I don't necessarily want to like part ways with that, but it's like pure carbohydrate. I think that's where the application of having a solid food option included is going to help out too. Because like, let's say you decide to like grab a handful of pretzels at the aid station and that's your solid food option. There's going to be a small amount of fat, small amount of protein in that. There's going to be some electrolytes in that. There's going to be a very small amount of fiber in that. You know, those things are going to be small enough ranges where it's going to be like a little bit slower to digest, and it's going to likely be a little less harsh on your digestive system versus like, you know, pounding 60 gels in a 100-mile race or something like that.
Gross. My gut would blow up if I tried that.
I always think about that. I was like, if you just sat me down on the couch and lined up 60 gels on the coffee table and just said, okay, you got 12 hours to eat these 60 gels, I'm pretty sure I'd be feeling like all sorts of miserable throughout various phases of that experience. And it's like, now you're asking me to run fast while I'm doing it. Like, I get that the metabolism is different in those two scenarios, but we are asking the digestive system to process that.
I'm just thinking of the no man can eat 50 eggs scene from Cool Hand Luke, and like, I'm going to like drag you out. No man can eat 60 gels.
I'm sure some people have, but I think they're probably the, they're the exception versus the norm.
Oh man. Yeah. I would not like to think about the scenario that would happen if I attempted that as well. Zach, this has been such an awesome and very considerate and thoughtful interview. I really appreciate how you've addressed these things and really addressed the context as being so important and really sticking with the most important things, which is finding things that you love. And if you know that you can eat these foods, which, you know, we're talking nutrition, but at the end of the day, people are eating food. They're not eating X number of protein and X number of carbohydrates. They're eating a sandwich or they're eating a steak and they're eating real food. And that's what it is. And so I really love your approach and I knew you'd be an awesome person to talk with this topic. And I think you've done a wonderful job. So where can people go to find you and connect with you and your work?
Yeah. So the easiest spot to see kind of everything I'm up to is on my website, which is zachbitter.com. That's where I kind of have like the landing page for my, my podcast, my social media channels, my newsletter, contacting me, coaching, all that stuff. And I'm probably most active on Instagram, which is just at Zach Bitter.
That's great. We will link to all that in the show notes. And it is important to note that you are coaching people. Is that something that's still open?
Yeah, I kind of have a pretty wide range of offerings for folks, depending on where they're at and what their needs are. And it goes from very individuals, one-on-one, where I build a plan specifically around their schedule and their race. And they can add, you know, phone support, email support, and things like that if they need more hands-on than just the plan itself. And then I've got it as scaled down as just some ready-made plans based on distances and kind of your starting point, like whether you're a beginner, intermediate, or advanced. So if people just want to kind of follow my philosophy, then sometimes they're fine with just those two. But those can all be found on my website. And I love coaching, so it's I try to keep it open as much as I can when time permits.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. I love that you have both of those approaches, more hands-on if needed, but also the more general, somebody can go to Training Peaks, you know, find a plan on your website and that can help them out a lot. Zach Bitter, thank you again so very much for this conversation and thank you for all of your work and everything you do. And thank you for coming on our show today. We really appreciate you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Casey. Anytime.
Absolutely. It was an honor. And this has been another episode of Balanced Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. It's really inspiring and amazing to see some of the reviews that we have been getting and also to receive so many messages and emails about how these episodes have improved our listeners' lives. And so thank you so very much. We are so happy to bring these episodes to you and provide them for free. And we really hope that they help you in your life. We have just passed two major milestones, which is absolutely mind-blowing to me. And basically, we did both of these in pretty much the exact same day. We have just passed 100,000 downloads worldwide of Boundless Body Radio, and we have just launched our 250th episode, which is absolutely amazing. Like I said, I never imagined we could reach that many people. We always want to keep you updated on things that we're doing on our website. So if you go to myboundlessbody.com, you can always see what we're up to. This month, we have a link that you can go and schedule a functional movement screen, which we do virtually over Zoom. A functional movement screen is a series of 7 different movements and 3 different clearing tests, which is designed to find weak links in the body, such as muscle imbalances and joint stability issues. It's a really great tool for discovering inefficient movement. And even if you're not experiencing pain in certain areas of your body, it's something that can prevent injury later on. Some muscles need to be stretched, some need to be strengthened, and we can help you create a plan around that so that you can stay healthy and continue to move well for the rest of your life. So again, you can go and schedule that at myboundlessbody.com. You will also see the other services that we offer. You can always schedule a complimentary 30-minute consultation with us to really chat about anything that you like. And remember, if you are enjoying Boundless Body Radio, please take a minute, give us a rating or review on Apple. It really helps get this passion project out to other people. And thank you again for tuning into Boundless Body Radio.